Welcome to Sunday Morning. It's a news and public affairs programming service of Cox Media Group. I'm your host, Mimi Lawson. Jason Tompkins is with us again. You've been with us several times, and I had the pleasure of being with you guys on Saturday. We're going to talk about that in a second. What is your title, actually?
I'm actually a licensed clinical social worker.
Oh, okay.
And in my day job, I'm in private practice. Mm-hmm. But my role with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is that I'm the chair of the board of directors.
Saturday, we got to spend a wonderful day in Straub Park. And I know we've talked in the past about these suicide out of the darkness walks, suicide prevention walks, mm-hmm. but I had never been a part of it. I want to thank you for allowing me to become a part of that Saturday. What an uplifting experience, which was surprising to me.
That's what I tell a lot of people who ask about our walks, especially those who might be coming for the first time after a loss, is that we are there to remember and honor those who have died. But we are also there to remember and honor the strength it takes for each person to come be a part of a day like this. And that's why you saw so many smiles, mm-hmm. you saw so many hugs, you saw so many people encouraging each other, because that's a part of who AFSP is,
right.
is giving people a reason to come to these events, and that reason is each other.
It sounds kind of silly, but I did see a lot of smiling and celebrating going on. And then there was a particular time in the day before we even got started with the walk that I started seeing people crying. And then I went, well, of course, that's what we're here for. I mean, it was that much of a difference in what I expected and what I experienced there, an experience that I would remember and remark upon.
A good friend of mine who runs a support group in Tampa uses the phrase ambushed by grief. And at events like this, you never know what might happen that might ambush someone. There were some right. very powerful stories that were
there
told
were.
From the stage.
There were.
Hannah, you remember hearing Hannah's story about the loss of her father and how moving that was as she found a strength inside of herself to keep going. And oftentimes there is a point in the day somewhere where it becomes emotional because
sure.
we're there because of a painful event or a painful struggle.
Let's talk about Hannah for a second. She lost her father. Mm-hmm. But then she talked about it having a real effect on her. And it was one of the questions I wanted to ask you this morning. Do you find, I know that you went through your mother's suicide, and how does that affect the people that are left behind? Is it not unusual for them to start having some of those same feelings?
Well, what I tell people that I'm working with when they start to struggle with thoughts of death is that suicide as a place in someone's mind is a thought. It's a place. It's an idea that comes up that needs the space to be thought about and understood and worked with. And I find that oftentimes that is something that occurs to people more closely after someone they love has died. They mm-hmm. they tend to have more thoughts about that. Now, when those thoughts become options and people start to kind of move in that direction, then the intervention and the work is a lot different. But Hannah told an incredibly brave, raw story about what her struggle was and how much she struggled with depression, how much she struggled with her thoughts of her own life and its value. And she stuck with that struggle. Mm-hmm. And then she found a way to kind of use her pain to help others. And one of the things I tell the board quite often is I'm impressed with how many of them have used their own, turned their own pains and own tragedies into triumph. And that's right. something that Hannah really exemplifies.
I think there is a, maybe not a misnomer about mental illness, that it runs in families. And I guess that was part of the question I was asking you. Mm-hmm. Do you find that a suicide in a family then will trigger that mental illness that was perhaps passed down through the family? Is that even true?
Well, we do know that the risk of suicide goes up in a person's life when a suicide happens close to them. The suicide in the family, statistically speaking, the rates for the family members go up. But there are lots of things that we can do to counteract those increase in suicide risk rates. I mean, there's mental health treatment, there's talking to friends. And one of the things that's been very important to me and what I've taken on as my role on the board is kind of the postvention efforts, because we do know that suicide postvention is prevention. And we have the International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day coming up on November the 19th in three counties, Pasco, Pinellas, and Hillsboro. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a day where people can come and hear other people tell their story. We'll have mental health speakers at each event kind of talking about self-care and how to grieve and move through a process like this towards growth. One of the new words that's come up in the mental health words in the mental health world has been post-traumatic growth.
Yeah, I'd never heard this.
the idea of kind of growing through your pain. And it's one of those concepts that's a lot easier said than done, but it is a possibility that many people are finding. And then we'll have breakout discussion groups for people to be able to go and tell their stories and hear other people tell their stories in a close, intimate way. What good is it to hear someone else's tell their story?
What is the positive about talking to someone who has suffered the same loss?
One of the consistent feedbacks we get from our Survivor Day program, from our walks, and even our new program, the Survivor Outreach Program, it comes in a few different ways, but people tend to tell us, wow, I thought I was the only one.
Right.
And to be able to sit there and hear someone else tell their story and to see someone else tell their story, because what you see when you hear someone tell their story, if they're laughing, if they're smiling, if they were just able to talk about a fun trip they went on yesterday, someone in the immediate grief forgets that those things are still possibilities.
Oh, that makes sense.
And so it connects them to someone who, in a way, has been where they've been and can say, ah, that person's smiling again. I wonder if I'll ever get to smile again.
I saw a lot of people at the walk who were joyous. There was a huge team. In fact, the team that raised the most money, and it was funny because we thought it was 14, then they said it was almost $18,000. This was the first time that this team had ever been involved with this. A huge amount of people supporting the person who had completed their suicide. Is it unusual to you that if that person knew that all those people were behind them, don't you think that would have helped to begin with? It kind of makes me sad a little bit.
It is sad. And one of the things that we do know about suicide is that there's a lot that we don't know. And it's hard to kind of make something make sense that doesn't make sense.
Right.
It has confused many philosophers and therapists and theorists for many, many years. But through research, some of the things that AFSP has funded, we found out that 90% of the people who die by suicide have a diagnosable mental illness. And so there's certainly issues around stigma that people feel like it's not safe or it's not okay to ask for help. In some parts of the country, in some parts of Florida, there's issues with availability of services. People don't even know where to go or know if there is a place to go to get help.
Right.
And so there are all these other dynamics that contribute to the high suicide rates.
So people don't know where to go. And we talked about the stigma. We've talked about the stigma before. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with a neighborhood blog. It's called Next Door.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. And a lot of people that I know go on it. It's great. You can find out if cars have been broken to in your neighborhood, or those kinds of neighborhood things. But I had seen a life coach recently that I thought was outstanding and had such a great experience with her that I posted it on Nextdoor because I, running a small business, have gotten a lot of business off there. I thought a lot of people really need to be exposed to this woman. And I thought it was interesting because the feedback that I got from other people on Nextdoor was, wow, that was really courageous for you. And all I said was, I saw this woman and had a great 2 hours. I wasn't talking about any of the issues. But I think it speaks to that stigma that a lot of people still are finding it uncomfortable and not socially acceptable to talk about these mental illnesses. I mean, even saying the word mental illness almost puts a stigma on it, at least in our society.
Right. I think there's a stigma from a societal perspective, and I think I may have told this story before in one of the interviews we did before, but I think there's an internal stigma, whereas, for example, if I've got strep throat, there's nothing you can do to stop me from going to the doctor and getting some medication because I want to eat. I like to eat.
Right.
My throat hurts. The brain doesn't work the same way. Sometimes the brain can hurt or the mind can hurt, but the mind and the brain can also get in the way of dealing with things because we think getting help can mean it's going to hurt more.
Right.
And we think that getting help is going to make it worse. And sometimes for a while, getting better does cause us to remember and deal with some painful things. But getting healthy and feeling better are two different things. And finding a therapist, finding a support group, even talking to a friend are all ways that we can kind of get better.
It was interesting to listen to the different people that were talking on Saturday. And you can see the grief. I mean, a lot of these people that were at the walk lost children. And that has got to be, I'm not saying that you didn't experience extreme pain when your mother died, but that has got to be one of the worst losses in the world. And of course, then you go into all that. Why did that happen? Look at all these people that are here celebrating and supporting this person. Is it sometimes the person can't see that around them? Where does that idea of suicide, can you explain how that comes to fruition? Is it something you still can't explain? You know, I don't want to get up out of bed this morning, like you and I talked about when we first came in. We could have slept all day.
Right.
It's a beautiful day. And never wanting to get up again. Are there physiological changes that happen, or is it an internal thing? There's so many things off of this I want to talk about.
Right, right. Well, it's an illness.
Okay.
Suicide, mental health, mood disorders, depression, bipolar, post-traumatic stress disorders, they're all illnesses and they all have their own course.
And a lot of people think those are weaknesses. They don't think of them as illnesses. I think that's where that stigma comes from.
Right. It becomes very difficult to advocate for people to get help or people to believe that they can reach out and get help when they're those types of mentalities in the culture around. Mm-hmm. But one of the positive things about finding help is that therapists are held to confidentiality. So the things that you talk about in there, they stay in the room.
Right.
And I tell my patients there are a few things that I have to offer: my education, my experience, my personality, for whatever that's worth. And then all those things are held together by confidentiality, because that provides the safety and the containment to talk about those things and make it safe to explore one's mind, which is the kind of the medicine, if you will, to dealing with some of the issues that can lead to suicide.
This is exactly, I think, what concerns people. They don't realize how important that confidentiality is. And it literally is the touchstone of your whole industry. You cannot tell anybody who's coming to see you what you talked about, things that you come up with. You honestly, it's against the law.
Right. And so that's so that it builds a place where it's safe to explore the mind, because everyone has their own inhibitions and risks of exploring their mind within themselves. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to take care of some of the concerns about what might be shared outside of the room, that's why we offer confidentiality for lots of reasons. It creates a safe place is the main reason. It makes the room safe to explore something inside that might not feel safe.
And I think that that's one of the things that people have a problem with when you say, well, I've talked to my friends, I've talked to my family. The other aspect of this, again, is your education, your experience. You've been around hundreds, unfortunately, or fortunately, of people who are dealing with this. So you do know there are concrete things that you can do. And I think that because people think it's a mind thing, that there's no pill that can be given, good and bad outcomes when it comes to antidepressants and antipsychotic medicine, this is not going to help, and that you don't know any more than their friend. And that's simply not true.
Right. And what we found throughout our work with AFSP is that sharing, and that sharing is a two-way street, to tell your story, to get to a place where you can tell, and also to get to a place where you can hear someone's story. And that's why all of our events, they're like community events. Our walks on Saturday, we had over 550 people.
Right.
And we got two more walks coming up. Our Survivor Day programs, there are three of those coming up, and there are 40 to 50 people at least at each one of those events. And there's kind of a power in being able to, healing power in being able to share and hear other people's journey and where they've been.
I remember you saying when you were speaking on Saturday that a lot of the money that you raise on these walks goes to research. What are we trying to research? What are we trying to figure out? Those very physiological things that I was asking about, or what is the prevailing wisdom in research now?
Well, there's a wide array of research topics that AFSP invests in. We've done research topics on genetics, like you've been asking about. We've done research topics on prevention. We've done research topics on postvention. And we've invested research dollars in trying to be able to understand legislation that can help prevent suicide, such as barriers, such as availability to resources, and those types of things. It's a wide range of topics that AFSP invests in. And those research dollars just don't go out into the ether and never come back. We bring research events right here, and we bring the AFSP researchers right here to the area.
Right.
And we did that a couple of years ago. We had three research benefactors of AFSP came and presented on their research.
What are you finding out? Are we getting better or worse at dealing with mental illness in this country?
I think we're getting better at being able to talk about it.
I
you see
too.
Crowds like you saw on Saturday.
That was
like
a lot of people. I was surprised.
Yeah,
it was a lot.
And there are people who just walk up. The walk is getting so big and it's getting well known that people just start, there's a big group of people. I wonder what that's about. And then we've got kind of the regular group of people who come every year because they're committed to the cause. So I do think we're getting better in making it safer to talk about.
Yeah.
But I do think that the statistics bear that the suicide rates continue to increase.
I heard you say that Saturday.
Yes.
You know, I know this is such a loaded question, but why? I mean, that's such a general question. Why, when we have now more resources, are people becoming or getting to the place where they think this is the only answer? Is it the economy? Is it just so full that we can't even answer that question?
Well, I think it is a very big question, and AFSP has taken on the huge goal nationally to reduce the suicide rates 20% by the year 2025.
Uh-huh.
And so we're studying some very specific ways in which we can, through legislation, postvention, and prevention efforts, reduce those rates. We just partnered with the National Sports Shooting Foundation, and over half of the completed suicides in the country are done by firearms. I think there are 33,000 firearm deaths a year, and about 21 to 22,000 of those are suicide
deaths.
That's
amazing.
And so if you think about what you see in the news media and things about risk and safety and crime, which are all incredibly important stories that we need to be paying attention to, two-thirds of the firearm deaths are suicide deaths. So people are at more risk of their death at their own hand with a gun than they are at someone else's.
I didn't realize that.
And so by partnering with the National Sports Shooting Foundation, what we're going to be able to do is start to get some prevention information and education information into firing ranges and gun dealers. And it's now a pilot program that's being used in 6 chapters in 3 states. And we're hoping in the next 2 years we'll be able to bring this to Florida and start kind of educating some of our gun dealers and firing ranges, just putting information. And like you said, it's a hot topic because firearms are a hot topic.
Right.
And we are only providing information. We're not taking a stand for or against guns. We are saying that, you know, this is a bleeding means that people use to end their lives, and this is some information that can help.
You said that a lot of people, one of the reasons that it gets this far is because they don't have access to health care or individuals that they could speak with. What are we talking about on some of the more outlying areas? Is this a problem? Is it just in Florida, or is it a statewide problem?
Well, there are certainly issues in rural areas where it can be far to get to places. There's some issues with affordability, and there are issues with what insurance companies will cover and how many sessions and the length of treatment that is sometimes needed. So it's a really complicated issue. And that's why things like the hotline, if someone's struggling, 1-800-273-8255 is a free crisis hotline that people can call and talk to, and they don't have to be in an immediate crisis. They can say, no, I'm having a hard time. I've had these thoughts of suicide. Let me call and just kind of get a mental health checkup with a professional.
I see.
And then maybe they can help refer people to resources like the Crisis Center in Tampa Bay.
Right. Been dealing with a couple of young people that are daughters of friends of mine, and you know, children of friends of mine who are having some problems in their 20s here. And one of the problems that I've seen in trying to help them is trying to get an appointment with a psychiatrist anymore is literally an act of God. It can take over 3 months to get an appointment. Is there anything that we can do as citizens, any way that we can vote to kind of change what's happening in healthcare? And that it just seems like that is the, if that's what you were considering and it was going to take you 3 months just to get your first appointment, which as you know is just kind of a comprehensive taking stats, I would just think that that would have to be excruciating.
Well, I would encourage families, as difficult as it is, to be incredibly persistent. And you said these are friends of yours, so it's great that these people have friends that they can reach out to and get help. And Tampa Bay has a lot of psychiatrists in the area, so sometimes people are limited by insurance, but maybe exploring going outside of the insurance panel.
Right.
But I acknowledge it can be very difficult to get appointments, and people are very busy. Psychiatrists can be very busy. Therapists can be very busy. And then even checking out some of the mental health organizations, maybe not people in private practice, but checking out mental health group practices.
And that might help you get an appointment a little bit earlier. I know there's plenty of, there's a place down in St. Petersburg near Central Avenue. I can't think of their name right offhand, but that was one that we tried to contact for this young woman as well. And, you know, you end up spending the whole day there. I can imagine how just painful, emotionally painful that could be.
And even a conversation with someone's primary care physician can be helpful, and maybe the primary care physician may decide to prescribe some medications in the interim until a an appointment with a psychiatrist can happen.
That did happen for her. So it's, I'm glad that you brought that up. Now we're looking at trying to figure out ways of making people's lives worth living. I mean, I don't know if that's the right way or say it or not. After you lost your mother, what were some of the thoughts that went through your mind? That were you already in practice when this happened? After you lost your mom, were your thoughts, you would never get over this, and how am I, were you already in practice at that point? So did you have, you know, a background to deal with what was going on in your family dynamic?
Well, I was certainly devastated and very upset, and it was very difficult to kind of think about what am I going to do the next day. I was seeing patients in various settings at that point. I had already graduated and gotten licensed. And I took the same type of guidance that I'm offering other people as I got involved with a group. I got involved with a community of people who kind of experienced something like this. And because you have a way of having tunnel vision that, oh my gosh, this is what happens, repetitive thoughts, repetitive memories. And of course, the time is filled with all kinds of things you have to do to take care of funeral arrangements and house things and the nuts and bolts of taking care of someone's estate.
Right.
So your mind is just racing. And I think what it was important to do was to be able to slow down and call a friend when I needed to talk. I tell folks sometimes it was helpful for me to cry when I needed to cry, scream when I needed to scream, and laugh when I needed to laugh, and to kind of hold on to those things. And as time went on, I was able to find out that every once in a while I laughed a little bit more. And one of the things that I wish I had 10 years ago that we do have now is a Survivor Outreach Program, which is a group of trained volunteers here in Tampa Bay who can be useful in helping people learn how to tell their story, learn how to kind of process this. All of the volunteers are lost survivors themselves. They've been trained and vetted to, so we know that they can sit with someone else without
right.
becoming overwhelmed with their grief.
Right.
And they are there to provide support. They're there to provide information about community resources. It's a 1-to-2 visit arrangement. It's a free service, and people can call me. It rings right to my cell phone at 813-314-7702.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask a few questions, and then I'll refer them on to a volunteer who will call them and set up the visit, like I said, to meet in their home or meet in a safe place in the community.
You know, I think that might even be better than getting some mental health, you know, being able to be seen, for example, by a psychiatrist like we were just talking about. First of all, it's immediate. It's somebody who's already been through the exact same thing that you have, and it's probably pretty raw, too.
It is, and what I tell the people who call is it can be helpful to have those calls in the immediate aftermath of a loss mm-hmm. in the first week or so, but you're in such shock during that time
right.
that the program is the most useful, like when the casseroles stop coming. You know, you have someone die and people's
yes.
there right in the beginning, and then the casseroles stop coming, and then it's, oh my gosh, now what?
Right.
And the Survivor Outreach Program, they've all been in that same place where they lost a sibling, a spouse, a child, a parent, mm-hmm. a cousin, a friend, whatever they lost. They're familiar with that. So they kind of have a sensitivity to be able to hear your story. And that's such a helpful thing, is to help people construct what their story is, construct and be able to put words to what they've
right.
been through.
Let me ask you, they're friends of friends that I've met in the last couple of years whose son took his own life. They are stuck in, it's been 10 years now, they are stuck in this. If they move on, then they are not honoring his memory. So they want to be stuck in, I lost a son. They still talk about it as if it happened yesterday. In fact, when I met them, I thought it had happened. And then to find out it had been 10 years ago, and I was recently at a wedding with them, and it is literally pervasive in how they deal with their lives. I, as a person, want to know how to talk to these people without saying the wrong thing. Yet I am somewhat uncomfortable and angry that they aren't able or willing to move on.
And it can be very difficult to know how to speak to someone
right.
who's lost someone, whether it was yesterday or whether it was 10 years ago. It's such a difficult thing, especially if you haven't had that the context to
right.
kind of know what that's like.
Exactly. And we've talked about this 100 times on the show. If you have not lost your grandfather and say to somebody else, I know how you feel, you don't. Simple as that.
But that doesn't mean that someone who has an experience of suicide loss can't be helped.
Okay.
To be able to just sit there and listen and realize that there are no quick answers. There are no quick fixes to this type of grief. It's not something that someone is going to feel better.
Right.
It's something that people will now have the obligation. My bias is I believe people have an obligation to keep living life, even if they experience something as tragic as this. So they have an obligation to find a way to keep moving on after something like this.
Is that why you see a lot of people do walks or certain things to honor the life of the person as opposed to how they died? I heard somebody say that to me Saturday. Mm-hmm. It's all about honoring my son's life, not about how he died.
Yeah, and Hannah said that about her dad as she was speaking on Saturday, that the loss is so tragic, and sometimes the loss is graphic, and it can become a very big story. And what gets lost is how that person lived their life. And,
mm-hmm.
and there's a advertisement on the radio, I forget which company it is, but they talk about the dash. You know, on the tombstone, the dash is what is important because it's the life the person lived.
Oh, I like that.
And I would add that it's not only the deceased person's life that's important, but it's our lives as well. Our lives are still going on, and our lives can still have purpose and meaning and joy and happiness. And then it's our obligation to be able to find an opportunity to kind of live that out.
How long has it been since you lost your mom?
10 years.
10 years. Do you find in that 10 years, because I know they were talking about time, Hannah even mentioned this, time doesn't heal time just makes things less painful.
I thought that was a brilliant statement from
Hannah. I did
too. I thought that was incredible. And I think time is the vehicle we use to heal. Mm-hmm. Time is necessary. We have to have time to help us kind of move in psychological and calendar space from the event.
Mm-hmm.
But in that time, we need to be in a supportive environment. We need to be around people who can kind of help us put words to what our experience was.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be able to kind of understand that suicide is a culmination of an illness.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke with someone on Saturday. I noticed she was sitting on a park bench and the walk had taken off. And I said, just say hello and ask how she's doing. She's very upset. She said, I'm having a horrible day, just an awful day. And she said someone had just ended their life and she felt like she was responsible because of some dynamics in her life.
Right.
And so I sat and I listened with her. I didn't tell her she was wrong.
Right.
I allowed her to tell me what her struggles were and the serious health issues she was having.
Mm-hmm.
And I did share with her that suicide is a result of an illness. And before I got up, she looked at me. She said, thank you. She
wow.
just needed someone to kind of be able to sit and listen. And
mm-hmm.
you were there Saturday. As great as it is, it's a lot of motion. There's a lot of activity.
Exactly.
And so we kind of have to watch closely to be able to see those moments where people need a hug, people need a moment just to be able to tell their story.
When you can feel that kind of good emotion from a whole group, hundreds of people who've experienced loss, there's a positive message in that.
I like paradoxes. And the walk really is a paradox, right? You
right.
go and people who come there, generally the majority of the people who are at the walks are people who've lost someone. You saw
right.
the signs and the banners remembering
and
loved
the beads.
Ones. And the beads, each bead, colored bead representing a different loss. There is a tragic nature that
yeah.
brings people together too. And it's yeah. something beautiful that comes out of such tragedies that I think makes the walk such a great day.
We talked about there are a Survivor Day coming up. Let's list those things again.
And so I'll give some information here, but everything will be on our Facebook page, facebook.com/AFSP Tampa Bay. But on November the 19th, we have our International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day. We'll have an event at the University of Tampa. We'll have an event at Empath Hospice on Roosevelt Boulevard in Clearwater, and we'll have an event in Pasco County at Medical Center of Trinity. And if you've never been to a Survivor Day event, if you've never heard someone exemplify such strength and courage to get up like Hannah did on Saturday
mm-hmm.
and tell their story, it's such a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful paradox, if you will. So we'll have survivor stories at each event. We'll have professional speakers at each event kind of talking about the experience of surviving a suicide loss.
You can find that on Facebook.
You will find that on Facebook, facebook.com/AFSP Tampa Bay. People can also go to SurvivorDay.org. And then the Survivor Outreach Program is the program that I was talking about where our trained volunteers can meet with people in the community or in their home in the aftermath of a suicide and provide support, connection, and hope. And people can call me at 813-314-7702. And like I said, I'll ask them a few questions and then refer them on to one of the volunteers who will call and work out the scheduling.
Very impressed with what I saw on Saturday. It really lifted my spirit, which is not what I expected.
Great.
And an out of the darkness walk.
We raised $56,000 in the cash and some
wow.
other donations haven't come in. Friday night, 13 Ugly Men are doing another fundraiser. So there'll be at least, I believe, 10 grand coming from that to go on top of
wow.
the wall. And then we have a walk in 2 weeks in Pasco County and on December 5th in Tampa. And people can go to outofthedarkness.org and learn more about the details from those walks.
Again, it was my pleasure to have Jason Tompkins in the studio this morning. Thank you for listening to Sunday Morning and have a great Sunday morning. Welcome back to Sunday Morning. I'm Mimi Lawson, your host, and Sarah Aldridge is with us. You're the marketing manager for the Morian Arts Center, is that correct?
Correct. Yes, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad you could join us. You have a very special event coming up on Saturday I wanted to talk about.
Absolutely. It's our annual big signature event. It's called Eat Rich, Play Dirty.
I love it.
And it's, next Saturday, November 5th.
It's all to support the Morian. Can you tell us more about the Morian? I love where you guys are located, first of all. Tell us about that.
We're right in the heart of downtown St. Petersburg in the Central Arts District. The Morian Arts Center itself has actually been around in some shape, form, or fashion for almost 100 years. We're
going to
be celebrating our centennial in 2017.
Wow, I didn't know that, Sarah.
Yeah, yes, this is actually our last big event before we start getting into the 100th anniversary stuff.
Cool.
So the Morian Arts Center really at its heart is just an arts education center. We do kids camps. We do adult and youth and teen programming year-round. So if you ever wanted to do anything regarding any medium of art, from clay to photography to metalworking, glassblowing, you name it, we do it 363 days a year. And we're a nonprofit. Our exhibition space is open free to the public daily. It's a wonderful place.
It is an awesome place. It's the old train station in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, that's actually one of our four facilities. So our main facility is right there on the 700 block of Central Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually own and operate the Chihuly Collection, which I'm sure a lot of people yeah. have heard about our recent relocation. So that's right across the street from us now. And that's really there to help sustain our educational programming that we do. But this event, yes, is in our historic train station building out in the Warehouse Arts District.
Really, really cool event. I was there last year and the food was outstanding.
Yeah, we call it Eat Rich, Play Dirty for a reason. So, you know, most arts organizations have a gala.
Uh-huh.
And I would say this is our version because we're an arts center. We like to be fun and funky and get hands-on. So it's a way to come to the train station. It's about almost 20,000 square feet. And we have tasting stations throughout. Rococo Steak was our wonderful partner this year and has put together this just absolutely insane charcuterie spread throughout the entire building. And then we have an additional 12 food vendors that are bringing in just decadent desserts.
Awesome.
So it's a nice kind of sweet and salty combination, but mixed in with all of that, DJ, band, hands-on art activities, so you can actually learn how to throw on the wheel if you really want to do that.
I think this is a fun thing to do on a Saturday night and then also be able to help out the Morian Arts Center.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the money, all the proceeds go to help support, again, our educational programming and all of our exhibitions as well, because we do, between all of our facilities, close to 40 exhibitions a year, and most of those are free and open to the public.
Awesome. How do we get tickets?
You can go online. It's morianartscenter.org. That's M-O-R-E-A-N, morianartscenter.org, and you can buy tickets right there or give us a call down on Central Avenue at 727-822-7872. Tickets are only $75 a head. Again, all the proceeds go to the Morian Arts Center, and of course, there's chances for silent auction items. We raffle off art by our professional teaching artists as well as a class with that artist. So there's a lot of fun stuff to do.
Great. I'm coming Saturday night, so I'm looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you, Mimi. Absolutely.
All right, so why don't you join us Saturday night, and you get the tickets again where, Sarah?
At morianartscenter.org or 727-822-7872.
It was good talking to Sarah Aldridge this morning. Thanks for stopping by on Sunday morning. We'll see you Saturday night.
You got it. Thanks, Mimi. Have a great one.